2012, March 6th. Today is Astronomy 141, Lecture 41, Interstellar Travel and Colonization. Well, we've been talking about other planets and, of course, the possibility of life on other worlds that might be on those planets. Yesterday, we talked about SETI, which is one scheme for possibly finding advanced technological civilizations by searching for their radio signals. And, of course, since they might do it, why don't we do it ourselves? And we have, in fact, sent out signals of our own into space. But the question I'd like to address today is, if we really found someone to talk to, or maybe they're looking for us, or we found a planet that was capable of harboring life, or maybe even did harbor life, had biomarkers, we'd probably want to go there. And the question is, how do we actually address the problem of interstellar travel? And if we go there, because of the long distances and long travel times involved, you're pretty much getting into probably staying there. It's probably not a round trip. And so the question is, what are the problems of interstellar travel and interstellar colonization? What are their challenges? And that's what we're going to talk about today. The first major challenge is the most basic. It's very challenging due to the vast distances involved and the relentless physics involved in this. These are very large distances. You need very, very high speeds to traverse those distances in a time that's reasonable to a human lifetime. And that presents tremendous physical challenges. We'll review what the current state of the art is in spacecraft, but it should not surprise you from earlier lectures that current state of the art fast spacecraft are way too slow to be considered for interstellar travel by orders of magnitude. It isn't like we're halfway there. We're not there by many powers of 10. So if we're going to have practical interstellar travel, we're going to see how that requires getting up to some reasonable fraction of the speed of light, and that's going to entail simply enormous energy requirements, and that's the main challenge of getting up to real star flight. Interstellar, interplanetary flight, we've been doing it for about 50 years. Interstellar flight, or star flight for short, that's a lot harder and a lot more energy. But if you accomplish it, it's probably going to be a one-way trip, which means we're going to be talking about colonization. And if we have colonization go on, what we're going to see is colonization is an interesting multiplier. It's actually an exponential process in the growth. We've seen this in human colonization on our own planet. That's how we went from a few to 7 billion people in a very, very short period of time. It's because of the exponential growth of colonization with the presence of technology as a multiplier. So even if you take what we're going to see is a very surprising conclusion that we're going to explore the consequences of in tomorrow's lecture, namely that if you can actually get even fairly modest starflight capability, you can actually, in principle, a dedicated civilization could colonize an entire galaxy in less than that galaxy's lifetime. It's a very rapid process, despite the vast distances, and we'll see how that works here towards the end. That has some interesting consequences that we're going to explore tomorrow. So let's go. What if we find something? That's what we're really spending a lot of effort, a lot of brain power, a lot of people are involved in looking for habitable Earths in their habitable zone. What if we actually find one? We actually have it there. We can take a picture of it. We see it's a pale blue dot. We take a spectrum. We find the spectral biomarkers showing the presence of life, at least as we understand life, or something that's tantalizingly close that we want to know what it is in detail. Or even more so, what if we received an actual message from an extraterrestrial civilization, something like the Arecibo message or the message you're decoding for problem 5? What are we going to do? Well, first of all, I think it would be a real game changer in terms of just the perception of humanity of its place in the universe, because we would know we were not alone. And I think in either of these circumstances, whether it's a nearby star with another Earth or an extraterrestrial civilization, just simply the way we're wired, it would be an absolutely overwhelming desire to go there, to actually physically be present on such a world. Whether we could do it or how long it would do it, what we're going to see today is that would basically require mustering all of the resources of our species and the energy requirements of our planet to do this. So is that need going to be that overwhelming? It just might. In fact, this might be the one thing that might actually, the science fiction writers might have gotten right. It might be something that actually might unite humanity rather than tearing it apart. So let's try to ask the question. I want to ask this question not from a science fiction point of view. I want to ask this from a very hard-nosed physics point of view. what are the challenges of traveling across the vast depths of interstellar space? So we ain't going to talk about warp drives are faster than light. It doesn't exist as far as physics is concerned. I'm going to confine myself to the question of how do we address the challenges of interstellar flight using the physics we know works through most of the universe? Getting there is half the fun, as the old statement goes, but it's all of the problem of interstellar travel. And the problem really boils down to basic physics. If we want to go, we have mass. That mass must be moved up to very, very large speeds. Accelerating mass requires energy. The greater the acceleration and the greater the speed I want to achieve, the greater the energy I'm going to have to expend. So that's problem number one. I got to be going fast, and it takes a huge amount of energy to do that. The second problem is the vast scale of interstellar space. Again, a little number to conjure with. In the solar neighborhood, let's say the planet that we find, the sort of, you know, other Earth-like planet, is on one of the nearby stars within the solar neighborhood, within about 15, 20 light years of Earth. The average distance between stars in our local neighborhood is 6 light years. That's in a vast distance. It takes light itself 6 years to cross that distance. We're not even close to the speed of light. This picture I've shown here is of the most powerful rocket that's ever been built by humanity, or at least certainly one of them. It's a Saturn V. I don't remember which of the moonshot for Apollo's this particular picture is from. I think it's actually from Apollo 8, which was the first spaceship that carried man, at least in orbit, around the moon in 1968. One is looking at 5 of the largest rocket engines ever built, or at least one among them. I mean, some of the Russian Energias, these are the so-called F1 engine. There are 5 of them firing in this booster to make the spacecraft break free from the Earth. The rest of the spacecraft up to this point is simply one big, huge fuel tank. The whole purpose of this was that little tiny triangular piece of metal at the top, plus a slightly smaller one hiding down underneath this shroud. This top piece is basically half a fuel tank. That's the fuel tank to make the transition from the Earth to the Moon. Inside this slightly conical shroud is the lunar would be the lunar module, and the 3 guys are riding just on top of that little triangle. Most of the mass of the Saturn V is the fuel to break free of the Earth. It's using chemical energy to do so. Therein, ladies and gentlemen, lies part of the problem. Your fuel just has a finite efficiency, and a spacecraft, no matter how cool looking, has to be mostly fuel carriage, for the most part, in a conventional design. So therein lies part of the challenge, and this is the other part of that challenge. This is the nearby space within about 15 light years of the sun, marking out all the known stars that we know of within that space. It's a tiny handful. It's 15 light years across. There's only 1, 2, 3 sun-like stars within our region. Okay, we'll let you have 61 Cygni, Epsilon Eridani, and Epsilon Indi to fill out the group. So there's just a tiny handful of plausible stars that might hold Earth-like planets. Yeah, maybe we'll spot it and we'll let you have an Earth-like planet around places like Barnard Star, some of these little red dwarfs. It's only a bare handful. And yet this is an essentially nearly unreachable challenge to get even to the first of these stars. With the fastest spacecraft we built takes a ridiculously long time. The current state of the art of spacecraft engineering is basically a chemically launched rocket, chemically boosted out of Earth's orbit, and then using gravity assist by the giant planets, primarily Jupiter, but you can use Jupiter, Saturn, and the other planets, to give a little bit of a gravity slingshot to get it up to the speed necessary to break free of the gravity of the sun, and therefore launch it into interstellar space. I'll give 2 examples of this. The fastest spacecraft at launch that we've ever sent up is the New Horizons spacecraft that was launched back in 2006. It's a probe that's on a mission to, by the year 2015, so just a few years from now, will be passing by the planet Pluto. But the chemical rocket we used, even though it was the fastest speed at that time, it has been steadily decelerating as it claws its way up out of the sun's gravity well. It got a boost passing by Jupiter in the year 2007. This transit time of about a year from Earth to Jupiter is one of the fastest transition times Earth to Jupiter for slingshot that's ever been done for a spacecraft. It's going to leave the solar system, be out where Voyager 1 is now, in 2029. Kind of to put this in some perspective, 2006 January is the year when I was still an associate professor, just before I was promoted to full professor. 2029 is probably after my nominal retirement date from The Ohio State University. I'll be 68 years old in 2029. Yeah, I'm 51 right now, even though I probably only look at a little bit. So most of my adult career will be occupied just by the transit time of New Horizons getting out of our solar system. Voyager 1 is currently the fastest spacecraft of all time due to a series of gravity assists, first from Jupiter and then from Saturn. It's moving away at a whopping 61,400 kilometers an hour. If it was pointed towards Proxima Centauri, the nearest of the stars nearby, it would take 74,000 years to reach Proxima at that date. In fact, Voyager 1 is not going to Proxima. Voyager 1 is actually pointing off in some slightly random direction of the constellation of Camelopardalis. It really wasn't intended to be going to any particular place. It was simply slung out of our solar system, more or less in the direction of the large sheath of the bow shock that represents the transition between interplanetary and interstellar space. So I think the closest it comes to any star is some little red dwarf or something like that. It's like a Lacaille star, named for the guy who did the catalog. In about 80,000 years, it'll pass within about 1.5 light years of it. So it's not really going, it's going somewhere, it's going nowhere fast, is a good way to put it. It's just going out into interstellar space. So that's the big problem, distance. The other problem is, back to that picture of the Saturn V, is the need to carry your own fuel in a conventional spacecraft design. So when you accelerate, you've got to expend energy. The way you expend energy is you carry a source of energy that you use as a fuel, as a propellant. That fuel must have a mass, right? A lot of the mass of the Saturn V, in fact, most of the mass of the Saturn V was its rocket fuel, liquid oxygen and the propellant that it was used. And the oxygen is simply the accelerator for the propellant. The more the total mass you're trying to send, the more the energy required to accelerate it. If I want to accelerate a baseball, that's a lot easier than accelerating a generational-sized starship. The more energy you need, the more fuel you need. But if you're carrying more fuel, that gives you more mass. More mass requires more energy, and you can see that's an exponential runaway. In fact, physicists who work on rockets call this the rocket equation. Your initial mass, which is basically your payload plus fuel divided by your final mass, is basically an exponential of your velocity divided by your exhaust velocity, the speed you want to reach. Now, you're not going to worry about what this is mathematically. What's important is this ratio here, your speed requirement, is as you increase your velocity, you end up with an exponentially increasing mass requirement. So if I want to double my speed or triple my speed or increase my speed by a factor of 100, to go from 1/10,000th the speed of light to 1/100th the speed of light, I've got to raise E, which is a number about 2.7, to the 1/100th power. So even though I'm making a factor of 100 increase in speed, I've got a gigantic increase in my fuel mass requirement. So this problem of acceleration requiring energy, but you have to carry your own fuel, runs into basically an exponentially growing requirement. Each increment of extra speed that you want requires exponentially more energy carriage and exponentially more fuel. So it gets out of hand really fast. Now, we now have these two challenges. I've got to bridge a vast interstellar depth. I'm impatient. I want to do it in a reasonable time scale. And 74,000 years is just a little too long for my taste. To put that in perspective, 74,000 years ago is two times longer in time than the time between us and the very first cave paintings. That's a long time in terms of human history. In fact, 74,000 years ago is arguable that there were actually recognizable Homo sapiens around. So that's a long time. So let's say we wanted to bump our speed up to 1/10 the speed of light. Okay, average distance between stars locally is about 5 to 6 light years, 6 light years, so we'll call it 5 light years in this example. Should have been 60, oh well. If I can get to 1/10 the speed of light, I can traverse 5 light years in 50 years. 50 years is a bit more tractable. I could actually expect to start a project like that and maybe have my grandkids finish it off. The energy costs for doing that are enormous because of the exponential growth required for getting up to those kinds of speed. But let's just grant that and say, okay, we're accepting we're going to have to carry a lot of fuel. What are the kinds of fuels we can carry? Clearly you want something with a lot of bang per kilogram. Bang for buck is really, money's not an issue at this point. It's really bang per kilogram of fuel. The state of the art right now is chemical fuel. We basically take an oxidant and some kind of propellant, we combine them and we burn them really fast and throw them out of a nozzle. That gives us the necessary momentum to move the spacecraft forward. And that's what we've been doing. So, for example, this craft has both combination of solid and liquid boosters. This is a Delta, and it's basically taking off here by expending its fuel. Its payload is a little tiny satellite sitting at the very top of this guy. But there are much more energetic forms of energy release available to us, particularly nuclear fission, through the course of basically fissioning of heavy elements like uranium and plutonium, or nuclear fusion. This is basically hydrogen fusion, deuterium and tritium fusion. Deuterium and tritium are isotopes of hydrogen, i.e. atomic and hydrogen bombs. Although, perhaps in a slightly more controlled fashion, or not, as the case may be. The maximum fuel efficiency we can imagine is an even more exotic form of matter, which is basically what's called a matter-antimatter fuel. I take every form of matter in the universe has its antimatter counterpart. A proton has an antiproton, an electron has a positron. We've observed these particles, they exist. There's a tremendous asymmetry in our universe for reasons that we still actually don't fundamentally understand. The equations of standard model of physics tell us, to a first approximation, the Big Bang should have made half matter and antimatter, equal left and right, if you will. It hasn't, and the disbalance is about a part in a billion or more. We don't understand that yet. That's one of the big physics problems going on right now among my colleagues over in the physics department. But we can actually make antimatter. We can do it in particle colliders, and we can actually make antiprotons and capture them and hold them inside of a jar. Okay, it's a magnetic jar, and yes, there's probably only about 100 of antiprotons in that jar, but we can confine them. You need a lot more than 100 protons. When matter and antimatter meet, they annihilate and basically release pure energy. So they have almost perfect E equals mc squared energy conversion. That's not quite true, because in fact, if you combine a proton and an antiproton, yes, you do get pure photons, pure energy out, but sometimes you also get heavy particles. So the actual energy yield calculation, especially if you get neutrinos, which can come out from some of these reactions, not proton, antiproton, neutrinos don't tend to be very useful. They carry the energy off. The conversion is perfect, but it doesn't give you useful forms of energy. So there is, in fact, a sort of an efficiency upper limit. A lot of science fiction stories and series like to use matter-antimatter as kind of the ultimate fuel because you get the maximal bang for the gram. So this would be the goal, is to come up with some kind of matter-antimatter fuel. We don't have that. Next down is fission or fusion processes. The most efficient fusion process we know of is hydrogen fusion into helium, which goes in our sun. It's 0.7% mc squared efficient. So you go from, I'll give it the benefit of the doubt, 100% mc squared efficient to 0.7% mc squared efficient to such a low number I didn't even bother looking it up. So therein lies one of the challenges. If we can actually figure out ways to mass produce antimatter, store it safely because you don't want to be anywhere near it when you drop some on the floor, this would be the ultimate fuel we want to use. So it's pretty clear that chemical's not going to do the job. It's way too slow. But we need to have some kind of way of doing this. So people have actually done this study fairly seriously. And actually, it was a very early study right after the end of the Second World War with the development of the hydrogen bomb. And actually, the Project Orion here actually started in 1956 or 57 during the Cold War. It was originally looked at as a concept for getting a spacecraft very quickly to Mars, which was still somewhat of a challenge for chemical rockets. Remember, in 1956, we hadn't even managed to get something into our own Earth orbit. But people were already starting to brainstorm ahead on how they might get things to not only other planets in our solar system quickly, but other stars. This is part of the whole Atoms for Peace movement, when people thought that nuclear explosives could be used for a lot of cooler things than simply blowing up the Soviet Union. It could be used for things like digging trenches and all that kind of good stuff. There were even people talking about nuclear-powered cars and nuclear-powered airplanes. That seems really ridiculous now when we understand how really dangerous radioactive materials are, but people actually were building nuclear-powered jet ramjet engines. And then they tested them and saw they were phenomenally dirty and thought, yeah, that's probably not such a good idea. especially what happens if they blow up. It takes out a whole city. Probably not a good thing. But they thought about, well, space is big and empty, so you could probably get away with actually lighting off some nukes. So one of the ideas was Project Orion. What Orion was a pusher plate. You would have a little hole through there. You'd push a nuclear weapon out the back, light it off, and then these are shock absorbers. And you'd basically push the thing along through a series of nuclear explosions. It sounds silly, but it actually works. You can get an awful lot of high yield coupling. The nukes are really small. They're really tiny yield things, but they give a huge push. They actually did an experimental version of this with chemical explosives called the putt-putt that actually dropped little chemical explosives out and actually pushed the thing up without rattling it apart. It was kind of a silly test, but it could work. And then people very quickly realized how really phenomenally expensive this was. There were nuclear test ban treaties that prohibited you from taking nukes into space. And it just became kind of impractical. But you could do this. And one of the concepts for Project Orion actually had a concept for a mission that reasonable extrapolation of, you know, this is 1960s technology, so materials technology and technology for miniaturization of nuclear warheads, made it feasible. If you had the money, will, and time, you could actually build a starship that could make it all the way to Alpha Centauri, the nearest star, AB Alpha Centauri, in about a century. And so that would be about the efficiency. You could actually get this thing up. Okay, it takes light about 4 years, so it's moving about 1/25th, a fraction of a percent of the speed of light, about 4% of the speed of light was thought to be the practical limit. The Brits actually got involved in this game in the 1970s. They had an idea which got developed into a concept called Project Daedalus. The idea there was, in fact, it was a nuclear fusion pusher. You basically would put a miniaturized nuke back here, and it would ignite inside this nozzle and be blown out there. This is a ship on a really vast scale. You'd build this thing in orbit. And the idea is you would basically use a micronuclear pulse. Later versions of this, instead of having a miniaturized nuclear weapon coming out, you would fire a nuclear pellet out there, and then a series of lasers around the outside would converge upon it, confine the fuel, and expand it. That's not a crazy idea. Laser confinement fusion is one of the technologies people are working on to build potential fusion power plants here on the Earth. They're not there yet. Go into Wikipedia or Google and look up National Ignition Facility at Lawrence Livermore Laboratory. That's an example of a laser confinement fusion device. I almost said laser confusion. That would have been interesting. So basically, you light off the pellet inside the nozzle, and that gives you a pulse. They're little small things, so these are not explosions that tear you apart, but you just basically go bang, 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 bang. Again, nuclear fuel, but just a novel way to ignite it. They actually felt that they could get up to a significant fraction of the speed of light, about a tenth the speed of light with some of the engineering concepts, which could get you to the nearby red dwarf star, Barnard Star, which in the 1970s was thought to have a planet around it, although that turned out to just be bad data. But it would get you there in 50 years. So again, you could build this and at least have a little bit of generational crossover when the spacecraft actually arrived. And at 6 light years, the round trip travel time for radio signals is 6 years. So it's a long, slow conversation, but you could do it. These were serious concepts, which really were only very small extrapolations of available technology. So there's no exotic physics here, there's no warp drives, there's no science fiction-y nonsense in this. This was hard engineering questions. Whether you could A, afford to build it, B, actually get the resources to build it, and C, whether it would actually work as you planned are slightly different questions. But they're actually quite plausible concepts. But you can see you've got to go to an awful lot of trouble. And the reason why you've got to go to so much trouble is because you've got to carry your fuel with you. So you've got to have a really high density of fuel. But there's another concept that people came up with to get around this. I've got to carry this fuel with me, and I've got to carry a lot. There were concepts which was to try to devise new means of propulsion that did not require that you carry your fuel with you. There were two of these with varying degrees of practicality. The fancy science fiction-y picture here on the right, or left, excuse me, is an example of what's referred to as a Bussard ramjet. It was developed by the late physicist Robert Bussard. The idea is that space is filled with interstellar gas, and you can scoop up this gas with basically a very large magnetic scoop. The magnetic scoop has to be quite big because space is quite empty. Mixed in with that hydrogen is the deuterium isotope of hydrogen, and deuterium is actually a relevant fusion fuel. Turns out hydrogen-hydrogen fusion, like the sun uses, requires a very rare kind of reaction, which occurs only when you have the vast amounts of material you have, like inside the sun. But there are slower forms of fusion that use deuterium and tritium that are more practical. In fact, the fusion reactors people are working with on the ground, trying to make a fusion power plant, involves deuterium, heavy hydrogen fusion, rather than light hydrogen fusion. Light hydrogen fusion just has a real problem with it. It's just inefficient. It's got a very slow reaction involved. You want something a little faster. And deuterium fusion is very fast. Deuterium is a small fraction of, heavy hydrogen is a small fraction of light hydrogen. It's about one part in 100,000, so you have to kind of get a big scoop. So the idea is you had a big electromagnetic scoop. Well, this just shows it's the nozzle portion. The electromagnetic field is actually developed by thin microwires going out. Again, it's not a crazy technology. It's just simply an extrapolation of scale. You would then gather in the hydrogen from this very large region, and then you have a compression and a nuclear power plant. The nuclear power plant now is used to basically produce the fusion reaction. So you scoop up your fuel as you go. It's an odd idea, but in principle it should work. The idea is that this could actually get you up to a significant fraction of the speed of light pretty quickly because you didn't have to carry an immense fuel mass with you. You simply gathered and scooped it up as you went along. Now, if this sounds sort of strange, note the word ramjet. Right? For a modern aircraft to fly through the air, it carries fuel, JP1 or JP2 or various types of jet fuel. But it doesn't carry an oxidant with it. It gathers its oxygen from the air as it flies through the air. It scoops up the air with those great big, ramjet scoops that you see in the front of a jet engine. So that cuts down the amount of fuel that a jet aircraft, a commercial jet aircraft or a military jet aircraft, has to carry by about a factor of two. The first jet engines were made by the Germans during the Second World War. They carried their oxidant and their fuel with them. They had a really bad tendency to do things like detonate if they landed too hard, if the oxidant was still left in the tanks, because it was hydrogen peroxide and it was unstable. Oxidants are really bad things to have to carry with you. We only use them on rocket ships because of A, the huge power density, and B, the idea of the rocket ship is to leave the atmosphere really fast, thereby leaving your oxygen source behind. There are supersonic ramjets called scramjets that NASA's been trying to develop for suborbital flight, but those are more difficult. So this is in many ways just an extrapolation of that idea. We do, in fact, build propulsion devices that do not carry about half their fuel because that's what a ramjet is. The other example of a propulsion device on the Earth that does not carry its own fuel is a sail ship. Remember sailing ships, sailboats? Their propulsion source, their fuel, is the wind. They simply unfurl a sail to catch the wind and use that to carry them along. Well, there are no winds in space of sufficient momentum carriage to be able to play this game, at least not around us. But light can actually act like a wind because it turns out that light bouncing off of something can produce a great deal of pressure called radiation pressure that can be used to actually accelerate a sail. If you ever see those little toys, a little bulb that's evacuated and got little paddles in it, and you shine light on it and it spins around. That's an example of a light sail, a very simple one. Now we had to evacuate it because the air drag would normally slow that down. So in fact, you could build a fairly small spacecraft and then unfurl a very, very big and very thin reflective mylar sail. You would catch sunlight and it would actually accelerate you. These have been built and they have been launched, small ones as test cases, and they do in fact operate. Now how you sail and tack is of course a bit of a challenge, but it can be worked out. You can also help this along with, it almost sounds like a certain comedian actually, this with giant lasers. You get a very big laser. What's a laser? It's highly concentrated lights, highly concentrated, highly directable light source. So you would fire a giant laser at the thing, not of sufficient power to vaporize it, but of sufficient power to push it along. So you would have the thing orbiting, and every time it came close, you'd blast it with a laser. You'd probably put it on the moon just so you didn't have to mess with the atmosphere. And each time it comes by, you give it another push. Sounds silly, but actually in reasonable engineering scenarios, you can get this thing up to about the tenth the speed of light before it gets out of range to where your laser push is no longer good. Once you're at a tenth the speed of light, you sail along towards your target star, and when you get close, when you start getting close, you unfurl a gigantic sail and begin the braking process. So this actually has a lot of practicality. It's lightweight. You don't only have to accelerate a small, relatively small mass, so it can be mostly payload plus sail. And people are working on, in fact, like I said, in the last couple of years, people have actually launched and tested on orbit solar sail concepts. The early versions of this will probably be used to send space probes out to the outer solar system fairly cheaply and quickly because they will accelerate rapidly. And an extrapolation of that technology could be used to develop a starship. Let's look at what the gap, however. Let's see what the real challenge here is in actual numbers. The speed of light is a big number, about 300,000 kilometers per second. Voyager 1 has a mass of about 720 kilos. That's really not that big. In fact, there are automobiles that are bigger than that. I built a spectrograph down in the basement of Smith Lab that goes in the Large Binocular Telescope that weighs 3,300 kilos. So this is a pretty poopy little spacecraft. That's like even that's even smaller than Mini Cooper, I think. It's moving at 17 kilometers a second. That's what 31,000 kilometers per hour translates into. That is 0.00006 times the velocity of light, 6/10,000ths the velocity of light. The interstellar travel time, we've already calculated that. It's approximately 100,000 years to make it out just past the nearest stars. Project Daedalus, which carried its own fusion fuel, had a projected mass in one of the design concepts of 54 million kilograms. That's 54,000 tons. It could achieve a speed maximum through the new fusion pulse mechanism of 0.12c, so barely an eighth of the speed of light, but that would cut the interstellar travel time down from 100,000 years to 50 years. So a big payload, most of it mass, most of it fuel mass, but it could get out to the nearest stars in about 50 years. The problem is that building something like this is going to be phenomenally expensive, multi-trillion dollars. It would require all pretty much a very big advancement in technology. We actually have just reached a scale of technology where we could, if we wanted to, build such a thing. But it would require basically the economy of our planet to do so. It would require the joint, some various estimates have been made of the cost of these things, which are probably wrong by at least a factor of 10, but it's basically the planetary GDP for a couple of decades. So you'd really want to be sure what you were doing. But you could do it. And if a civilization reached a point where they could afford to do it, had the resources to do so, it is technologically feasible to do so. There is nothing in Project Daedalus that has not already been demonstrated here on the Earth, on some level or another. It's a matter of scaling it up and the willingness to pay a huge price for it. Well, let's say you could do this. Let's say you actually reach a point of reach a point of technological sophistication that we're and access to resources. It could be mining asteroids, for example, to do, get those resources. That we have the will to build starships and we find places to go. Earth-like planets and their habitable zones. Maybe some of them are places where we might live, decide that we want to hedge humanity's bets. After all it takes is one asteroid with our name on it and game over for our species. So you want to kind of hedge your bets by spreading the species out a little bit, making sure it goes somewhere where if Earth gets taken out, there's somewhere else where the species continues. You want to then go on and do colonization. This kind of technology or extrapolations from this would permit you to do so. And again, it's not a crazy extrapolation from current technology. If a civilization actually decides to solve the problems of building a relativistic starship, a starship capable of achieving speeds close to the speed of light and therefore subject to the rules of Einstein's relativity, then what? Well, what did we do when we developed new forms of transport on the Earth, right? For most of human history, we moved basically by foot power or occasionally animal muscle power when we figured out how to domesticate the horse. We never moved very far from our own homes. We moved barely 50 kilometers until we actually developed the ability to cross the seas in wooden ships. And then the pace of colonization of other portions of our planet went very, very fast. The usual pattern of that colonization kind of went as follows. There'd be a single ship that would head out, probably containing crazy people or people who wanted to go somewhere because, well, they got itchy feet and they were curious what was over the horizon. They went out, and actually, a lot of them didn't come back. But occasionally, they did come back. And they came back and told about the new, mostly empty land they found. Yeah, there's some people living there, but we won't worry about them. It's a different story for a different day. Then people thought, well, let's go exploit that. So more ships went out, but instead of being people who went out, mapped it, and came back, there were people who went out to stay. Instead of explorers and map makers and sailors, you sent people who could build things, who could grow things, and could actually live there, and you start new outposts. Those people eventually, you know, took a while to get established, but once they got established, they started building their own ships and heading out. And they would begin to explore. Look at the population of the North American continent after the discovery of the North American continent by the Europeans. Previously, humanity had nearly 100,000 years to get around the problem of populating the North American continent, and did so. It took a long, long time. North America was populated when the first Europeans arose. The distance and time between the appearance of the first Europeans in roughly 1500 and the establishment of the United States as a separate nation on the eastern portion of the United States was only a couple of centuries, not a couple of millennia. So it's a very rapid process once you head out. So you start with a home system, and each new place you go becomes a new home world. They will eventually reach the point that they will then become a center for traveling to new home worlds. After all, let's say you want to get there. If you go from here to there, that's an awfully long trip, but you can do it in a couple of steps. And you build up the resources at each point, so if that star has a nuclear war, that star has a zombie apocalypse, all these others are there and available to continue on the species. So you end up with a pattern of exploration, colonization, and further colonization out, and you begin to grow branches like a tree. That's what we did. That's how we went from a few thousand people crawling up out of Africa less than 10,000 years ago, and within 10,000 years, we populated the entire planet to 7 billion people. Yeah, question in the back. The question was, is terraforming a realistic concept or is that just science fiction? Actually, it's probably a realistic concept if you think about how it would work. The question is how you would actually go about it in practice. But take a look around us. We are quite now capable of altering our environments, right? We can deforest places. We can dam rivers. We can change the chemical content of our atmosphere, right? We may not be wanting to do that, but we are, in fact, doing such things. Well, what if you actually set your mind to doing that? It's quite possible. Whether you want to do that or whether you have the actual technical means is a different question, but it's technologically feasible. There's no new physics, no new chemistry, no new engineering that needs to be developed, except maybe to make it cheaper, but not to make it possible. Good question. So here's the thing. Colonization, once it gets rolling, is an exceedingly rapid process. We've seen this over and over again through human history. And as the technologies to travel and move large numbers of people get better, the colonization goes very rapidly. I won't use the numbers, but compare, for example, how long it took to colonize the Polynesian islands compared to what it took to colonize the planet after the development of advanced technology, for, aka ships, for moving people around in large numbers. So basically what you do is you're going to start playing the game here where the home planet, we're going to play this game here, where we send out two probes. They go out to two ships, and they take 500 years to establish themselves. So they go out in the direction because, you know, they might get there and find out, you know, it isn't just simply bacteria there. It's something really bad, and they all die. So you want to kind of hedge your bets and go in two directions. After one generation, we'll assume they survive, each of them sends out two probes. So the number of places we get to is now goes from 2 to 4. The next generation, starting with 4, sends out 2 probes. That gives you 8. And you can see it's a very rapidly exponential or geometrically growing process. After 10 generations, the number of branches on the tree is now 1,024. It's like the old story of the guy who was going to be rewarded by the king, and he said, what do you want? Do you want gold, riches? No, just put a penny down on the test board and then double the number of pennies in each square. And pretty soon the king, who didn't apparently take math, gave him his entire kingdom because, well, 2 to the 64 is a really big number. Sure enough, just 10 generations down the line, I've got 1,000 colonies. Now, this is assuming no losses. So you start factoring in losses. All that does is slow this down incrementally because you're growing exponentially, but you may not be necessarily losing colonies exponentially. You might lose them in onesies and twosies. So you get geometric growth, but incremental loss. You still get net geometric growth. After only 38 generations, that's 300 billion potential colonies and unchecked exponential growth, there's only 200 billion stars in our own galaxy. So even if you have centuries elapse between each successive colonization step, you can very quickly populate the entire galaxy. So here's doing some numbers. Let's play the numbers and do this right. We're going to take as given that the mean distance between habitable stars is such that if you can build a fusion starship capable of a tenth the speed of light, that's relativistic star flight, and it takes you about 50 years on average to get to the nearest habitable world. Okay, give them a little time to get themselves established and then get around to getting the resource and exploitation up to speed where they can build their own colonization ships, and they fire those off at the next two stars in line. The inhabited region that you have, where you look at the zone that's filled with basically humans colonizing the galaxy, will grow at 1% the speed of light. The rate of growth may be incremental, but viewed over the long time will be an outwardly spreading sphere of humanity. Unchecked, you run the numbers and you make some reasonable estimates as the number of plausibly habitable worlds or habitable stars in our galaxy. You can complete the colonization of our entire Milky Way galaxy in 10 million years. So that's what an exponential process grows you. From very small starts, as long as you can sustain it, the unchecked answer is 10 million years fastest. Everything you do only slows this down. And that's relatively modest. Furthermore, this is assuming a relativistic starship. Let's play the game with a much more modest starflight capability. Let's stay sub-relativistic. Let's say we never get to that magic tenth of the speed of light. We only get to 1% the speed of light. Now it takes you 500 years to go from the nearest star from the sun to the nearest habitable star on average. That's longer than a human lifetime, but you're going slow, so you build a big ship that can contain multiple generations of people. So you may leave with the initial crew in your ark, as they're called, leave the Earth, and 500 years later, your great-great-great-great-grandchildren are the ones who arrive at the habitable world. Planetary lifetimes are measured in billions of years. It's not going anywhere. We just got to deal with the shorter lifespan of human beings. And maybe biological changes can up that lifespan with medical care and advanced genetics treatments. Who knows? And then you kind of wait around for about 5,000 years to send the next one out, because that kind of exhausted you. You want a few generations to pass. This inhabited region will still grow at 0.1% the speed of light, 1,000th the speed of light, which means you could actually still colonize the entire Milky Way in 100 million years. The current age of the Milky Way is 10, 13 billion years. So with a relatively modest assumption, even modest starflight capability, as long as you've got the will to keep it moving for 100 million years, and that's a mighty big if. After all, we're as a recognizable species, we're only 100,000 years old. But when you have multiple centers, you've got multiple possibilities. At the end of the galaxy, it may be a different species than human. We may have evolved into something more interesting. No species has lasted, well, there's a few species that have lasted that long. It'd be kind of strange. So, here's the deal. Even with a very, very modest starflight capability, and you don't even have to be relativistic, if you're willing to do it, the colonization time, the time it takes you to inhabit every plausibly habitable world without even... Who needs terraforming? You just simply find the next habitable world that's already ready for you to show up. With reasonable assumptions, you get an exponential population dynamic come into play. Now, remember the Drake equation. The Drake equation said just sort of spontaneous formation of single civilizations was maybe a few to a few tens in our entire galaxy instantaneously. But that assumed those civilizations stayed put. If those civilizations go on the move, then you add an exponential population dynamic upon that very light, modest start. So if at any given time there are 10 or 20 advanced civilizations in our galaxy, that's really thin on the ground. But if any of them starts the colonization process, it will magnify exponentially. So even if we give the most pessimistic version of the Drake equation and give you a really modest star-flight capability, the galaxy should have been colonized over and over again in total through its 13 billion year lifetime. The numbers are absolutely relentless on this. So this leads us to a question. If that's the case, then why is SETI still a notion? Where is everybody? And that's the question we'll pick up tomorrow.